Now, Ray mentioned that I stole his translator. I have issued apologies for stealing the translator, and I've compiled all of the times that I have apologized into one slide, and it's being projected right now. I have never apologized, nor will I ever apologize for stealing your lovely translator. So, appreciate you, Ray. It's been a real blessing knowing Ray over the years. Let's see. Speaking of slides, can we get them up and rolling? Let's see. All righty. For those who were with us in the first session, we discussed divine institutions. For those who were not, could those who were with us before tell us what the three divine institutions are that we discussed? The individual, the family, and the country. Oh, goodness. Speaking of odd individuals. There we go. Okay. Oh, goodness. That's the presenter view. Yeah, there we go. Great. Appreciate you. So we're going to use the divine institutions as a metric for evaluating certain political ideologies, which I'm calling post-fascist. Post-fascist ideologies are those that have developed from the fascist ideologies of the 20th century and continue today with similarities to fascism, having elements that cannot be removed without collapsing the whole system, those elements coming from fascism. Today it's unfortunate that we use the term fascism at most to mean I disagree with you. Oh, you voted for so-and-so. You must be a fascist. Oh, you don't support my idea on this. You must be a fascist. Oh, you put ketchup on hot dogs. You are definitely a fascist. Blah, blah, blah. Whenever we use such language, it is unfortunate because it diminishes a very significant political theory that caused a lot of damage. And we need to understand these political theories so that we don't repeat the same mistakes. But first, a little about myself. I'm from Texas originally. I was raised in a Christian environment. I moved to Ukraine. Ukraine's the one on the right. Texas is on the left. I was raised in the youth group. I was very active as a young one in the church. And unfortunately, I, along with many others who were raised in a church environment, became what today would probably be called a deconstructionist. That is to say, I apostatized from the faith very early on. Christianity, as it was presented to me, was very watered down. I understood the gospel pretty well. I could draw a pretty nice prophecy chart, I think. But the holistic worldview that we derive from the Bible was not something I was able to piece together. It was more of a fun and games kind of social club, church was. So I abandoned Christianity in my late teens, went off and joined the National Guard. I graduated high school shortly after September 11th, that kind of puts a date on me. And shortly after that, I found myself as an infantryman in Iraq. It was quite a challenging position to be in, and I think probably the greatest challenge of it all was how do you explain all of the evil that's going on in the world without a consistent worldview? And this is not a challenge that I think is unique to soldiers in the least bit. It just happened to be my circumstances. Whenever I returned to the United States, I lived a very foolish and evil lifestyle that was consistent with my anti-biblical bent. And before long, I found myself in federal prison for possession of an unregistered firearm. My friends and I were making pipe bombs as kind of a hobby and blew up a statue of the Virgin Mary with one. Such behavior is frowned upon by society. It is also illegal, as well it should be. You don't want people running around blowing stuff up in society. So I ended up in prison. While I was there, I was confronted with a particular realization that most people in prison are there because of snitches or they themselves are snitches. The police, whenever they arrest people, they will try to get them to snitch and inform on other criminals in the area. And typically a criminal will sing like a bird if he thinks it could reduce his time sentence any. However, whenever we look at the events around the resurrection of Christ, his closest friends said that they saw him resurrected, and they were willing to even be imprisoned and died before renouncing this. That's not the way criminals behave. The only rational explanation I could come to, knowing how criminals behave and knowing how the apostles behave, is simply that Christ was indeed resurrected. And if Christ is resurrected, then that is like a domino chain effect, because it means that God resurrected him, which means God approves of what he said, which means that that which he said was true all the way down. So I returned to Christianity when I was in prison and had the opportunity to study systematic theology and apologetics and develop this worldview idea from a biblical perspective. And I realized, wow, Christianity has the answers I was looking for the whole time. And I decided that whenever I get out, I want to dedicate my life to helping other people understand the Bible as a holistic literature that informs every area of our life. Then I got to thinking, well, how do I do that? Should I become a pastor or a missionary? When I was in Iraq, I was one of the better Arabic speakers in my unit, and I am not a picky eater. If you're good at languages and you're not a picky eater, it seems you should be a missionary. So that's what I did. I got out and I went to the University of Texas at Arlington, got a bachelor's degree in Russian. Then, as Ray mentioned, I moved to Ukraine. I wanted to be a missionary, so I became an immigrant first. Went to seminary online, got a master's degree at Liberty, and then D-Min at Tyndale. Recently, I have returned to Liberty. I'm now working on a PhD applied apologetics. The information we've discussed in the last hour and this hour are actually the topic of my dissertation that I've been working on for a couple of years. I Googled around and I found Word of God Bible College. That's the place where Ray used to teach, where Lena translated. I just typed in Free Grace Dispensationalism Ukraine because I knew Russian and that's what I found. So moved out there, met Lena. We fell in love and all that mushy stuff and got married. And I was still working in downtown Kyiv at the time, and my commute to work began looking something like this. Does anyone remember this? What year is this? Anyone? 2013, actually, yeah. So Maidan Revolution started in 2013, then the invasion of Ukraine started in 2014, not 22. It was 2014 that the war began. Some opportunities opened in Lviv, Ukraine, in western Ukraine. So we worked out there for a bit, and we started Grace Abroad Ministry shortly thereafter. There's no photographic evidence that my entire family has looked in the same direction at the same time. In 2020, we started having opportunities to teach in a more global aspect. We have always had a passion for Western Europe. Unfortunately, it was 2020, so we started the International Society for Biblical Hermeneutics. We published several books, and we do webinars every month. We have a presentation. Our current series is on Israel and the Church. So we have been doing a lot of work in Western Europe as well. Last year, we were in, Italy, Denmark, UK, Poland, and Germany. We're hoping to go back to Europe this fall, also to do some branching around. Now, we've gotten to 2020 by this time in our chronology. And if you recall, there was some weird stuff happening in 2020 during all the shutdowns. There was a really unfortunate occasion in Minnesota where Mr. George Floyd passed away while evading the police. I don't know anybody who thinks he should have died. That's not a criminal offense, but it was interesting seeing how a lot of people started becoming experts on criminal justice at that point. And the Black Lives Matter movement started rearing its ugly head. Now, the phrase Black Lives Matter is a statement I think we all agree with. If you think Black Lives don't matter, then meet me in the parking lot afterwards and I will beat the living daylights out of you. The Black Lives Matter is not opposed to Black Lives Don't Matter. It's a, however, when you look at what the Black Lives Matter movement is about, you find that it's actually built on a completely different framework than the Bible. It is one of social justice as defined from neo-Marxism. A lot of Christians, I think, have been very intuitive to the fact that this mode of thinking is heretical and bent against Christianity. Not everyone has been, though. There was, you've probably heard of the organization Campus Crusade for Christ. It's a very broadly evangelical organization. A lot of them started going woke, as we say, started teaching a social justice form of soteriology. And so some guys within Campus Crusade, used to be called Campus Crusade, Crusade has a particular connotation of rape and murder. So the Campus Crusade for Christ changed their name. They kept the rapey part, shortened it to Crew, and then dropped Christ out of the name, so it's just Crew now. I don't know. Okay. So around this time, I started noticing that there was a shift in evangelicalism toward wokeism, toward leftism, toward social justice. So around that time, I started doing some academic work defending the divine institutions from a dispensational framework, because when we look at what wokeism does, it attacks the divine institutions. So we saw kind of a rift in evangelicalism going on then. But the more conservative ones of us, I think, have been intuitive that leftism is a false way. As we move forward, we get into 2022, and Russia starts escalating violence against the Ukrainian people as part of a greater struggle against the West. A lot of murders took place in the street. I've covered his face, but here's Vitaly Vinogradov, who is the dean of Kiev Evangelical Seminary, who was murdered in the name of Russian unity. Every evangelical to the man in Ukraine is in agreement that Russia is the bad guy here. Ukraine is the Bible Belt of the region. It's the place where we have Bible colleges because it's free. It's a place where Russia, Belarus, it's where Kazakhstan, Central Asia, it's where you send your guys to get trained before going back home to start churches, because Ukraine is, it's the most Christian-friendly location. However, once this stuff started kicking off, I noticed that evangelicalism, again, was faced with a rift, just like with the wokeism before. Now I'm noticing that a lot of Christians are starting to actually be supportive of the Russian agenda. And I think this is often based in perhaps ignorance of what the Russian ideology is all about. So, returning to the topic, originally I was wanting to pursue a PhD anyway. I was more interested in hermeneutics of Genesis. I've talked here before on Egyptology. I was studying the Egyptian language through Manchester, but the war changed my priorities a bit. And so now I'm studying still a Genesis topic, but relating the divine institutions to leftism and what we call Russism, the ideology of Russia, and how we can use the Bible to refute these ideas. Russism, by the way, is a term that has emerged from Ukrainian literature. I don't see it much in the English language, but it's a combination of Russia and fascism, Russism. So we already talked about the divine institutions, the individual, the family, and the country. In this talk, we'll talk about post-fascism. We'll do a quick overview of those divine institutions, then we'll look at a historical development of Russism and leftism, the post-fascist ideas. And then we will evaluate them on the basis of the divine institutions. So, that by way of introduction. So first things first, doctrinal considerations. We discussed that a worldview has at least these four components. Epistemology and metaphysics describe the way things are, whereas ethics and sociopolitical philosophy describe the way things ought to be. If we are thinking logically, we would develop our worldview from the bottom up, starting with epistemology and going to sociopolitical philosophy. However, the tendency and the pressure from society is always from the top down, starting at sociopolitical philosophy and going down to epistemology. I find that people who are supporting Russia, who are otherwise conservative evangelicals, they're on this particular point allowing the sociopolitical agenda against leftism to kind of drive it rather than the Bible. So let's think more holistically. We discussed last time the divine institutions, which you defined as follows. Divine institutions are social structures for the benefit of humanity, of which God designed all people to be members by default. The divine institutions are the individual, the family, and the country. Last time we talked about the individual. We talked about how these are defined biblically. The Bible is our epistemological source of all of our worldview issues. We derive the divine institutions as our metaphysics, and we allow that to drive our critiques of sociopolitical philosophy. The individual we discussed in terms of the systematic doctrine of anthropology. We looked at ontology, what are we? We talked about metaphysics, what are we supposed to do? We discussed the family. We determined that there are two facets of the family. There's the marital relationship and the parental relationship. And we talked about the country, which we derive from the Noahic Covenant, where we get the idea of a civil government, as well as the Tower of Babel dispersion, whereas we get the idea of distinct territories for the civil government in order to protect the people of the land. So, without backtracking too far, let's keep this in mind. Let's maintain the Bible as our source of truth. Let's maintain these divine institutions as a biblically based metaphysical layout of the world so that we can approach these questions of what the woke left is telling us and what the Russians are telling us and say, wait a minute, is this aligning with God's design? All right, so those are the doctrinal considerations. Let's talk a little bit about the historical development of these goofy ideas that are coming down the pipeline. So I've thrown out a couple of terms here. One is woke theology and one is Russianism. Let's define our terms here. Woke theology is a syncretism. What is syncretism? Yeah, it's when you take two different religions and squish them together, right? Sikhism would be a syncretism of Hinduism and Islam, for example. So woke theology is a syncretism of Christianity with the fascism of critical theory that sees the kingdom as inaugurated and seeks to build the kingdom through acts of social and ecological justice as aligned with its secular counterparts. This is what I saw going viral in evangelicalism back in 2020, and it needs to be addressed. A worldview with similar roots is this one, Rushism. Rushism is the worldview of Russian fascism, which is characterized by a desire for a few great powers instead of many distinct countries, an emphasis on group identities over great expanses, and compatibility with the Russian Orthodox Church's interfaith mission of symphonia with the Russian state. Now, that was a mouthful. How did we get there? To understand these two worldviews, it is helpful to understand the history that led up to them. We can put wokeism and Rushism as kind of a post-fascist ideology that came as a development of fascism. But fascism itself is a development of communism, which itself is something of a reaction to this political ideology called liberalism. Now, when we say liberal today, sometimes we think like politically liberal, left-leaning Democrats, kind of stuff like that, right? That's not always the way that the term is used. By liberalism here, we mean classical liberalism. Classical liberalism is the ideology that the American founding fathers were working from. It emphasizes the individual as a sovereign unit. Let's take a look at a liberalism sample text. Here we have the American Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Okay, this is the kind of thing we're talking about when we talk about liberalism. Notice what it's presupposing here, that there is a creator, and that the Creator has designed the individual to be something that is free and unique. I think there is biblical support for this kind of thinking. Now, granted, there is a lot of room for criticism for the early Constitution of America, which kind of came out of this, right? We say all men are created equal. How is it then that we can have slavery? That is a contradiction by nature. And to America's credit, we had a very bloody civil war to set that straight. I happen to think that we who are conservatives, who are conserving the liberalism of old, should find much to celebrate about Juneteenth. That's not a liberalist, a leftist holiday. That's our holiday. That's a liberalism victory, not a leftist victory. Now, liberalism has an economic theory associated with it, that is capitalism. Capitalism has given us much more prosperity and wealth than any other economic theory in history. A result of great economic prosperity is that some people are richer than others. And so we have communism, which tried to break that. Now, communism goes through a couple of phases. Here's a sample text of communism. Karl Marx, speaking of religion, says it is the opium of the people. So automatically, they're starting on a different foot, an atheistic worldview. But look at what he's doing. He says the higher nobility is struggling against the monarch, the bureaucrat against the nobility, the bourgeois against them all, while the proletariat is already beginning to find itself struggling against the bourgeoisie. So in Marx's view, we have an epistemology of oppression. The whole entire world needs to be viewed as the oppressor oppressing the oppressed. If you're the oppressed, you're the good guy. If you're the oppressor, you're the bad guy. Another aspect is that the oppressor-oppressed dichotomy is economically driven. If you are rich, then you're the oppressor. If you're poor, then you're the oppressed. Now, communism has failed every time it's been tried. The first great failure is in the Soviet Union in Russia. They attempted it. It was Leninism, Marxism, and it failed. It failed partly because it's just a bad economic theory that cannot work, partly because it's an atheistic theory that doesn't align with the reality of the universe. But another problem is, how do you even implement communism? How do you get people to just give up their property? A common defense of communism is communism has never been tried. Well, let's entertain that thought. Okay, so communism hasn't worked because it hasn't been tried. Has anyone ever tried to try communism? Well, yes, they tried. So what you're telling me is not only that it fails if it's tried, you're telling me you can't even try it because it's so bad of an idea. And then you can try, oh, well, it's never been tried to be tried. Okay, so you can't even try it to try to try it, right? That argument does not defend the communist worldview very well, okay? So while that's going on in Russia, some philosophers in Frankfurt in the Weimar Republic start thinking, okay, maybe we need to revise communism. Maybe instead of being an economic theory, we can make it a social theory. Instead of just the rich oppressing the poor, maybe there are many critical groups that are being oppressed. It could be based on gender, women being oppressed by men. Maybe there's a there's still an economic element, the rich oppressing the poor. Perhaps there's also a racial element. Maybe we, the true Aryan race, are being oppressed by the Romani and the Jew. So critical theory kind of develops out of that as a development of Marxism. Now, they're both maintaining the anti-spiritual bent. They're still in this atheistic perspective. Problem is, even your critical theory can't be enforced well. How do you implement it? Enter fascism into the scene. Now, the father of fascist philosophy was Giovanni Gentile, born in 1875, assassinated in 1944. His writings are the typical boring philosophy, Italian history, blah, blah, blah. If you really want to learn fascism, I recommend reading Mussolini, who is the politician of fascism, the voice of the people. He describes fascism pretty well, saying anti-individualistic. Remember, the individual is a divine institution. Fascism is bent against that. Anti-individualistic, the fascist conception of life, stresses the importance of the state and accepts the individual only insofar as his interests coincide with the state. He says the fascist conception of the state is all-embracing. Outside of it, no human or spiritual value can exist, much less have value. Now, his criticism of socialism is not the economic theory. What he's doing here is saying what we need to do is emphasize the state, give the state control of all property, and have the state enforce the socialist ideologies. Hence, national socialism as a fascist ideology that came out of the German side was a development of this critical theory into a state control version. By the way, fascism gained a little bit of popularity in America. Will Rogers, who never met a man he didn't like, actually met Mussolini, wrote a couple of pieces in favor of Mussolini, saying he's the good guy. Meanwhile, in the Weimar Republic, it advances to become the Third Reich, taking this idea of critical theory that we, the Aryans, are being oppressed by them, the Jews, and using the state to enforce a national-based socialism. A lot of Americans were opposed at first to involvement in World War II on the grounds that Hitler didn't attack us. So there are some interesting parallels going on today. Now, when we think about the conflict between that's going on in World War II between the National Socialist and the Soviet Socialist, we see them at great odds, one emphasizing class, the other emphasizing race. That is a difference. But really, I think if we look at it, the differences are rather superficial. In reality, they're both working on this atheistic, Darwinistic metaphysics, which itself has a Marxist feel to it. Okay, they're both building off an atheistic Marxist sense. They've just got slightly different turns in how they're expressing it, and it leads to the great bloodshed of World War II. Now, it's interesting because today a lot of guys are returning to the fascist thought. For example, Paolo Pozzola is a Russist ideologist. He works with the Jagiellonski Universitet in Krakow, Poland. And when he speaks of the Russian ideology, specifically when he's discussing what came before, the fascist ideology, he speaks of its premature disappearance in 1945. So with these post-fascist ideas, they're thinking, well, wait a minute. Fascism is just a further development of this socialism. We never gave fascism its fair day in court. We need to revise it a little bit and try it again so that it can really flesh its way out. Okay? So that's how we go from this fascist ideology to a post-fascist era. There's a current desire to go back to fascism, not 100%, right? They're not saying Germany should rule at all, like the German National Socialists. There's some difference with the Italian fascism, but there needs to be a revision into a post-fascist ideology. All right. Now, the two manifestations of that are wokeism and Russism. This is what we've been leading up to. Let's take a look at wokeism first. Specifically, I'm concerned about the theological expressions of these, because that's what's starting to happen in evangelicalism. Let's return to the definition. Woke theology is a syncretism of Christianity with the fascism of critical theory. Remember how critical theory was Weimar Republic, Frankfurt School that led to the National Socialist German fascism version. That sees the kingdom as inaugurated and seeks to build the kingdom through acts of social and ecological justice as aligned with its secular counterparts. Now, there has been a significant advancement in this line of fascist thought since the collapse of fascism in 1945. If you remember, the Frankfurt School gave us critical theory, where there are several critical groups that are being oppressed. In the 1980s and 90s, we started to develop here in the West an idea of intersectionality, which is probably a term that you've had shoved down your throat. The idea being that any individual can be a member of multiple oppressed critical groups at any given time. And, of course, following the classic Marxism, the more oppressed you are, the better. This has worked its way into various forms of theology. So we have Pamela Lightsey, who is an African-American queer lesbian womanist scholar. Notice all the different critical groups. In her book, Our Lives Matter, A Womanist Queer Theology, she represents the view well, saying the disenfranchisement of women intersects with the disenfranchisement of black men, of poor people, etc. The disenfranchisement of black lesbian women intersects with the disenfranchisement of transgender women, and so forth. But more succinctly, the questions of race and the questions of sex are always inextricably related. We see this being applied to queer theologies, which try to challenge what the Bible says about marriage and sexuality. Queer theologies undo traditional theology by deconstructing it, by critiquing the patriarchy and heteronormative assumptions at play in its productions. Queer theologies liberate Christianity from the bondage of patriarchy and heteronormativity. So this would be one form of woke theology. Notice that it's constantly trying to topple Christianity. We need to recognize that Christianity and queer theory do not go together. Rebecca Volkel wrote a book called Carnal Knowledge of God, in which she expresses well the necessity for an eschatology that is here and now, an already not yet form of eschatology. And then the idea being that we can grow this kingdom that's already here through acts of justice for the queer folk. Of course, the Bible does not present the kingdom as now, so there are no instructions for building the kingdom, certainly not through sinful measures like this. Phyllis Trible is a feminist theologian who says, "No woman can serve two authorities, a master called Scripture and a mistress called feminism." I actually agree with her. You can't have both. However, I think she would say abandon the Scripture. I would say uphold the Scripture. Lisa Isherwood is a feminist theologian who wrote a chapter called Feminist Christologies, showing that this feminist approach to Christology ended up quite heretical, because if Christ could not experience being female, then the question arose as to whether or not the female state could be redeemed. Then they redefined the soteriology. Redemption, then, within feminist Christology is about liberation. Therefore, it involves struggle against oppression, as well as struggle for personal integrity and human freedom. It's about wholeness and transformation. Notice the complete lack of anything about Jesus dying for sin. Their soteriology is not that you can be made righteous, but rather that we can make life a bit more comfortable now. We see the same thing with racially charged forms of woke theology. Mission Integral is Brown soteriology. It's the mission of the whole church, the whole of humanity in all its form, personal, communal, social, economic, ecological, and political. Nothing about Christ. So that's the pre-fascist critical theory being developed in the post-fascist era. One particularly interesting aspect of the fascist side of things was evident in the DNC, the Democrat National Convention, back in 2012, when they showed a video making this statement: "The government is the only thing we all belong to." Remember the bit that we saw by Mussolini earlier? That's coming straight out of his mouth, basically. Okay, so that's how wokeism works. They're continuing in that same critical theory school, developing it further with intersectionality. I don't think we really saw that with Hitler. They're developing it further, so there is a distinction, but they're maintaining the state control on that framework. Now let's talk about Russism. Here's the definition. Russism is the worldview of Russian fascism, which is characterized by a desire for a few great powers instead of many distinct countries, an emphasis on group identities over great expanses, and compatibility with the Russian Orthodox Church's interfaith mission of symphonia with the Russian state. As mentioned earlier, symphonia is the Eastern Orthodox approach to government, whereas the Roman Catholics had the two-sword doctrine where the Pope appoints the emperor. Symphonia says that it's the church and the state working together to rule the country. All right, now to understand the Russism, the Russian fascism, it's important to understand two philosophers who were party members for the National Socialist German Workers' Party. These are Carl Schmitt, who is pictured up here, and Martin Heidegger, who is down in this Nazi gathering. If you want, you can read their Wikipedia articles. They're both very prominent members of the party back when it was active and continued developing post-fascist thought after the collapse in 1945. So Carl Schmitt's big contribution to this discussion is this work. He wrote a political theology. which is not to be mistaken for any kind of Christian theology whatsoever. But in his political theology, he developed a theology called Grossraum in the German. That funky-looking lazy B letter is actually two S's, because German doesn't care about your feelings. Grossraum means big space. Do we have Germans in the church today? Am I right? Is that a fair statement? I joke. I love my German friends. Am I saying Grossraum correctly?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. So Grossraum means big space, right? Carl Schmitt's contribution to National Socialist thought was the idea that instead of having many distinct countries, which is the biblical prescription, we should unify big spaces and have one giant Grossraum instead of several distinct countries. So in his perspective, Germany needed to expand, unite the Rhineland, and have one Grossraum rather than a distinct Poland. Okay, that's the political theology of Carl Schmitt. Martin Heidegger is another National German, National Socialist German Workers Party member and philosopher. He is particularly influential to the Russist discussion because of this guy. Alexander Dugin is a Russian philosopher. He's been called Putin's brain. You might have seen him recently. He's starting to get a bit of a following in America through certain personalities that are platforming him. I've been following him for a bit longer than he's been viral in the States. I've translated a couple of his Russian snippets from various Russian texts that he's written. Some of these have been translated into English elsewhere, not all of them. He says, the subject of communism was class, fascism was the government, in the Italian fascism of Mussolini, or race in the Hitler version. In liberalism, the subject was the individual. So we've looked at that so far. So Dugin's fourth political theory, coming after fascism, so fourth political theory, Russism, same thing. He says, finally, we can outline the deepest ontological basis of fourth political theory. That is to say, Martin Heidegger, the National Socialist German Workers' Party member that we've just seen. So he's seeing its development along these lines. Blah, blah, blah. What is it that Martin Heidegger said that he loves so much? Well, Heidegger's ontology is called Dasein, which means being, more or less. He says the enemy is one who possesses essential threat to the existence of the people. Existence here is Dasein, and its members. The enemy is not necessarily the outside enemy. So Heidegger is discussing how we can have enemies inside our community, which are different from us. The enemy may have grafted himself onto the innermost root of the existence of a people and opposes the latter's ownmost essence, acting contrary to it. All the keener and harsher and more difficult it is than the struggle with the goal of total elimination of these outsiders within our community. It's a little esoteric and weird, but in the Nazi days, this was kind of defined as, hey, those Jews are the outsider. Hey, the Romani is the outsider. Hey, this group is the outsider. We need to relinquish them. By the way, this is not something that he wrote, I understand, like during the Nazi days. He continued as a professor after the fall of the National Socialist Party and continued developing and promoting this ideology in post Hitler Germany. His estate did a good job of trying to keep this under the covers, but it has come to light in recent years. So that's the ontology, Dasein. Now, Dugin appeals to Carl Schmitt, who created the doctrine of great spaces, Grossraum, as a project of future unification. Remember, unify the Rhinelands. So Dugin here says we need to return to that with an idea of establishing many Grossraums, many great landmasses, on the level of the mainland or the continent, rather than the distinct countries, which we saw was laid out in the biblical approach. He identifies the enemy as the United States. Does anyone want to take a wild guess at when this was written? You've heard it said that Russia wasn't our enemy until 2022. Right? Some would say till 2014. Actually, this was written in 2004, over 20 years ago. Russia has been the enemy this whole time. The notion that we were friends back then is invalid. So his approach is called multipolarity. The idea being we need to approach something more like this, where we have several big spaces, about a dozen, rather than the hundreds of individual countries that we have today. Of course, there's a difficulty of where to draw the lines and how to actually put this into force. Perhaps it should look something more like this. Now, a defense that I'm frequently hearing for the Russist approach is that they're opposing globalism. And that's a good thing, right? Because globalism is bad. I would agree globalism is bad. It's also interesting, though, because if you go to the World Economic Forum, which is kind of a big deal for leftist thought, go to their website, type in globalism in their search bar, you'll find that globalism was indeed kind of a buzzing term prior to COVID-19 in 2020. They even had like globalism 4.0 is kind of a thing. That was back in 2018, 2019. Post-COVID, though, their big thing is actually multipolarity, the same thing that the Russist is going for. So the left is multipolarity, wanting to dissolve borders. Russian is multipolarity, trying to expand borders. We see this being echoed through clear statements by Vladimir Putin shortly after the escalation of violence in Ukraine. This is the beginning of a transition from a liberal, globalist, American egocentrism to a truly multipolar world. Whenever we had the civil unrest in West Africa a few years ago, it happens that Russia had their own influence in there as well. And you can see that they kind of divided the land into the more Muslim Dasein Grossam in the more traditional religion. And it happens that the Qs align very well with that. We see Russia being deeply anti-Semitic. We mentioned earlier that if you look at their partners in the war today, and if you look at what we are anticipating in Ezekiel, there's a pretty nice alignment. I tend to think this is because Satan doesn't know when the Gog-Magog war is going to happen, so he frequently keeps a man on deck to make it happen. Finally, we mentioned in the definition of Russism the cooperation with the Russian Orthodox Church. Christianity has as a basis to its notion this idea that you are inherently separate from God, and that Jesus died on the cross and paid for your sin, that if you believe in him, you can be made righteous. Russian Orthodoxy is a different religion. According to Patriarch Kirill, who is the Russian Orthodox Patriarch, anyone who dies in the war against the West will have washed away his own sins. Does that even sound like Christianity? No. There's a lot of overlap with Islam, actually, and so there's kind of an interfaith mission going on there. All right, so we looked at the historical development. When am I supposed to shut up again? Right about now? Or shortly. Shortly? Okay. So, we're making good time then. Let's evaluate post-fascism then. On the basis of the individual, the family, and the country, okay? Both post-fascist ideologies, leftism and Russism, are diametrically opposed to each of these. Neither leftism nor Russism is a viable political theory that honors God. As far as the individual is concerned, both leftism and Russism are dissolving the individual. Leftism wants you to identify as a group identity, right? Moving toward that intersectionality, moving toward your critical theory, try to find the group that you are oppressed as. Russism is also dissolving the individual through this concept of Dasein and Grossraum, saying you need to dissolve the individual into the collective. The family is under attack on both. Now, the left does have some interesting ways of attacking the family. Part of that is through critical gender theory, trying to redefine people's genders and make it to where marriage is no longer one man and one woman. A lot of people, I think, are seeing Russia as opposing this idea and standing for traditional marriage. And we should stand for traditional marriage, right? Traditional marriage sounds like a good idea, so long as the tradition of marriage is biblical. Which in America, it's been a lot more biblical than elsewhere. However, with the Russist approach, traditional marriage should be upheld wherever it happens to be. In some cultures, traditional marriage is very abusive and even polygamous, right? That happens in the Muslim world disproportionately. It's unfortunate. And it's interesting how the Russian Orthodox Church is endorsing Islam as a viable option. Russia is not necessarily opposed to the leftist gender theories here in the West, as long as they stay in the West, right? We should be allowed to do that, according to the Russian thought. I would say that leftism is wrong universally, no matter where it is, okay? In addition to this, Russia has also abducted over 20,000 Ukrainian children as part of the efforts to relinquish or destroy Ukrainian identity. This falls within the definition of genocide following the Geneva Convention. As far as the country is concerned, we've already seen that both leftism and Russism are opposed to the individual country idea that the Bible describes. Instead, they both want to go for a multipolar approach. People accuse both of them of being globalist, wanting one power. I wouldn't be surprised if they would like one power. It's just that I think globalism has proven itself to be unviable. So they're doing the next best thing, which is multipolarity, perhaps on the way to globalism. And if you're interested in eschatological impacts of that, it could be that we're moving toward multipolarity now for a future setup of a globalist empire. But in the meantime, multipolarity is an evil idea, both the leftist idea that we need to dissolve borders so that America and Mexico are one pole, as well as the idea that we should extend borders, which is the Russian ideology. Okay, so we did some doctrinal considerations, looking at those three divine institutions. We looked at the history of post-fascism, and if we use the divine institutions as our metric for evaluating a political ideology, we will see that both the left and Russia fall very, very short. There's another apology slide for Ray.